Beauty Unplugged, the podcast. Welcome to another episode of my podcast, She Unplugged. And today I bring to the table, so to speak, one of those names, in my opinion, dealing with leadership and finding a new way of actually leading not just our companies, our organizations, our families, ourselves, but the world. Because she's taken her model of leadership and looked at it in the current situation globally. And I think that's why it's one of the most important topics we can talk about right now. What can we do to get through this change, to get through this crisis, and what can we learn from it? Welcome, Nilyum.
So nice to be with you, Anyal, and happy 2021.
Happy 2021. You've written a book, Shakti Leadership, and you start off in the book talking about the hero's journey, Campbell, who described it. Could you, for the listeners and viewers who aren't aware of what that is, give a quick review of the hero's journey?
So Campbell was an anthropologist, and he discovered that mythologies across cultures seem to be telling the same story. And it's the story of how, as human beings, we come of age from being the innocent child to really grow up to become the adult and a person of consequence and, you know, someone who brings meaning and purpose to their world. And he discovered there is a very classic map to this that is common across cultures. And that effectively is the hero's journey, saying that we each are the hero of our life story. And we're like the central character, and all around us is a cast of characters. Now, the reason I use the hero's journey in the Shakti leadership work and bring it to leadership is essentially to be a good leader, you have to really bring the heroic out from yourself, out of yourself. So it takes courage. It takes heroism. It takes bravery, right? To be able to step into your leadership, even if it is about leading your own self. And talking about the time we are in right now, it's that the hero's journey doesn't just happen to the individual. It also happens to a culture. It happens to a collective. It happens to a company. It happens to a team. It happens to any entity that is evolving here will go through a heroic journey in order to come into its own. So I thought we could also discuss this if that's of interest to you.
I really like that idea because we know it from the literature. Any book that is really, really well written, if we start by Harry Potter, or I know you also talked about Lord of the Rings and all these books, they all follow the classic hero's journey. And we know that it starts with a crisis and then we go through it to make the hero's journey. But what I really like to believe is that we don't have to start off with a crisis. We don't have to with some bad news, may it be unemployment, divorce, an illness, a death. That's usually what brings the movement, that brings the change. But you argue that that's not necessary. We don't have to start with a crisis.
Yes. So, you know, obviously after I read his entire amazing book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and I also read Maureen Murdoch's book on the heroine's journey, on how women journey differently than men. So first of all, you know, it's got many steps, 17 steps on the journey. But to simplify it, it's there's a crisis which shakes you out of your normalcy, and then you're thrown into this magical, special world, and you go through trauma, and then you have to meet your worst fear, the one thing you don't want to do. And if you're able to really face that lowest point in your life successfully, you come out on the other side transformed. There is a growth that takes place in you in order to have overcome that terrible, terrible one thing you didn't want to do, right? But now that you've done it, the good thing is that you transform in the process. And then the last piece is sharing that transformation, that gift. It's called the elixir. You come back to your old world and you give it, because that is the medicine your world needs to heal itself. So a very simple model is to remember crisis, trauma, transformation, and gift. And as I looked at this, I said, wow, is this the arc of our human experience on how we, you know, wake up and grow up and show up and make the difference we are here to make in the world? But really, do we have to go through the pain and suffering? Isn't there an easier and better way? Personally, this was my story, because I've gone through several crises in my own life, and I look back and I realize, having successfully navigated them, I'm fortunate that I can look back and see them as gifts and as blessings, but I'm not sure I want to continue to grow through crises, right? So it was like, hey, isn't there a better way? And that's when I kind of put it together, and that's what's in the book, saying, why wait for a crisis? How about you await an evolutionary impulse, right? You, when your life seems like it has become comfortable, and we've somehow kind of arrived in a little bit of a comfort zone, and everything starts feeling a little too easy, that is a sign that life is never meant to stagnate. We are forever meant to grow. So the minute we start feeling a sense of comfort and stagnation, it is a sign that we have to wait the call to adventure. It's going to come anytime. And instead of waiting for it as a whack or a crisis, to actually willingly step into the magical zone, which is let go your comfort and put yourself in your edge, you know, put yourself into some discomfort. And so I would call it dissolution.
How could we do that in practical terms? Because what you're describing, in my words, is like stepping out of the comfort zone into the unknown, yeah, where growth happens. But yes, does that actually just mean doing something that I haven't done before? I don't know. What does it actually mean? Can you give 2-3 examples?
It literally means doing something you've not done before, which you actually fear doing. Because it would mean letting go something that is easy and nice. It would involve letting go some status quo. So, for example, when our children left home and we became empty nesters, we were living in this massive 4,200 square foot apartment, yoga hall, meditation garden. And it was fantastic for the 9 years when the children were growing up. But once they left home and my husband and I were just rattling around in this large place that is too big for us, we chose to leave. Mm-hmm. We chose to downsize. We chose to move from Bangalore, where we were not really doing much of our work, but to move to Mumbai, which is a very difficult city to find a place to live. It's really hard work to find the right place. It's very expensive, but we chose to let go this beautiful life we had carved out for ourselves. And we decided, let's figure it out. Let's go to Mumbai. Let's start anew and let's downsize. So we moved to a place that is 1,200 square feet. And even to date, when our friends now visit us here, they're really shocked. They say, wow, Neelima, Vijay, never imagine you living like this. And the truth is, we chose that dissolution of the old lifestyle, which was actually too consumptive. It was, you know, we imagine all the electricity, the water, the resources being used in, you know, living in a large place, going to the airport, 1.5 hour drive either way. So it was just no longer sustainable. And we decided we'd rather downsize and move to a more convenient place where we can step out and the airport is 30 minutes away and can get on a flight and go anywhere in the world. And so we kind of put ourselves into a whole new start.
Mm-hmm. A whole new kind of life situation.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong, not everybody is at the place where they move or something. So the ideas I heard, cook something you have never cooked before, take the risk of it failing miserably.
Yes.
Or in business, if you have never really voiced your ideas, if you never in a meeting said, but I think, try that. So that is what I'm sensing, is that stepping out of that comfort zone, making myself vulnerable.
Yes.
And available to new lessons. Is that, but tell me if I'm wrong.
Totally, totally. But one deeper thing here, and because the hero's journey is archetypal, it is rarely what you see on the surface. And the minute you take on something superficial, you will be forced to take on the deeper work along with it. Mm-hmm. Because a hero's journey requires a deep inner transformation. So be assured that it will require a death of some kind, which is not easy. Yes, you're putting yourself into, you know, you're trying something new, but you're willing to fail. You're willing to be seen as stupid. You know, so your ego will take a knock in some ways, and parts of yourself that you perhaps were, you know, proud of or holding on to as a crutch for your identity, you're going to have to let parts of your identity die. To make your journey consciously, you're going to have to step into a place where some sort of a dissolution is being asked of you. You're going to have to die in some way. And that means dying to an aspect of yourself or your previously held identity. Mm-hmm. In a very simple way, it's like saying, you know, you cannot fill a cup that is already full.
Yeah.
You have to pour out what's in there so that you make space for something new.
And accept that as part of the process. When you hear it for the first time, I think even when you hear it for the 10th and 20th and 100th time, it kind of like a little bit stops the breathing, because it's one of those things, well, I have to let go of part of me and some part of me has to die. And that is worrying, that is frightening. And maybe I don't even know which part, because that's the other thing. Maybe it's the part that I really cling on to, that gives me strength, that gives me purpose, at least in my ego tells me so. So it's like, okay, it's like jumping into cold water, you know, when you jump in and you can't breathe for a minute because it's so cold. That's how that sentence feels to me.
That's very brave of you, Anya, to acknowledge that. But, you know, you asked the question, is there a way to make the journey consciously? So it's not going to be easier than the hero's journey. It's going to be even harder than the hero's journey. Okay. So the typical hero's journey, in a way, forces you to wake up and change through the crisis. And we are asking the question, can't we do it without the suffering? So yeah, if you want to do it without the suffering, then you're going to have to take on something even more challenging.
We've taken the step. We let go of some part of our identity.
Yes.
In our self-chosen journey.
Yes.
What is the next step? How do we come out again?
So one is to let go something and dissolve. We call it dissolution. And then the other is to take on something that you haven't done before. So this is how you're going to build some new muscles. So if you understand that the hero's journey is essentially a way to make you grow and evolve into capacities that were otherwise merely potential in you, they were unawakened, they were latent in you, then in the conscious journey, you actually step into something that you know is potential and you're now going to train for it. So take on something that you know is there in you, and you make yourself learn it, practice it. And, you know, it could be learning how to ski, or it could be how to face your fear of flying, or, you know, it could be, you know, whatever is your deepest fear, to turn around and go into it.
When you talk about it, what I'm seeing an inner film. I'm going through a process of physiotherapy for months now.
Yeah.
And I started off by just doing fitness.
Yes.
And it felt safe, and it felt, you know, I pushed a little bit, but it was good. Then I came across my personal trainer, and he invited me to step out of that comfort zone. And now, and I've just done it this morning, it's the process of learning something on a physical level that makes me very uncomfortable, that is frightening, that some days it works and some days it doesn't work, and having to cope with the joy when it works well, when I can do the exercise well, you know, when I feel safe and in balance and in control, and also experiencing the disappointment and the disillusionment and the sadness that comes when on other days it doesn't work. And it's just really building that muscle, like you say, doing it over and over and over until hopefully my body learns it again.
Yes, yes. That's a great example. You know, just physical fitness is a great example of a conscious journey that you're choosing. You're not waiting for a heart attack. You're choosing to, you know, get on the treadmill and get a personal trainer and wake up in the morning and put your body through the rigor, so that at the end of it, you feel amazing because there is evolution. So you evolve in some way, your body gets better in some way, your fitness levels go up in some way, right? So that would not have happened had you not put yourself through the discomfort of the physical training regime.
Very true. Unfortunately, I waited for the crisis. So I'm on the hero's journey. I was pushed into the crisis, but I accepted it. But that's how I see it when I compare it to the physical exercise, because it's really training that muscle.
Yes.
It's a new behavior. It's a new thinking. It's a new way of doing things. And I always compare it to the physical body and to a muscle, and it needs training. And you do it once, nothing will change. You need to do it 1,000 times, 2,000 times, and you need to be able to accept that sometimes you fall back into your old behavior, and then you go again, 2 steps forward, 1 step back.
Until a day comes where you are 4 steps forward, 2 steps back.
The thing is, for me, it's the getting up in the morning and doing it regardless of knowing how it will be. I don't do it because I know I will feel great afterwards. There are days I don't feel great afterwards. But it's that commitment. I have started the process, and now I will continue it. And hopefully I will get to the day when it's 4 steps, and maybe there will never be one back. I don't know, but that commitment I've made to myself and to that process of trying to come back up. What's the next step in that journey now?
So there is evolution, right? So having allowed a dissolution and having taken on some unrealized potential, when you actually succeed, you evolve. So there is personal evolution that has been done consciously. So you can even call it conscious evolution, right? You've not waited for a crisis. You have consciously evolved yourself. Now, here is the interesting part. When you are in this evolved place, it can be very fabulous and delightful and almost seductive, because everything's great and you're feeling, you know, you're on top of the world. But the hero's journey and the conscious journey does not put you through a crisis for just your own evolution. There is a larger purpose to it, which is where it's so perfect and beautiful, that you are basically like the imaginal cell of the new human butterfly or your community. So you have to come back to your tribe, your world, and you have to help something resolve there. So there will be some issue or problem or stuckness in your tribe, your community, the larger context that you used to be a part of. And your growth journey has brought you an elixir, a capacity, a quality, an ability that you now need to bring back as the medicine that your world needs. That is the elixir, so that there is resolution to its crisis and its problems.
It's actually, when I listen to you, it's a gift to the world. It's a gift to the community, to the village where I'm living or the town. And it's, if I look at it from the hero's journey, it's my, can I use the word duty, to bring it back so other people can benefit from it.
Yes. In fact, your journey isn't complete until that last piece is done, even though it may feel complete for you.
And that last step, I think that's another challenge for a lot.
Yes.
People to bring it now back to the community and to stand tall and say, look, this is what I've gone through. This is what I've learned.
Yes.
This is my offering to you.
Yes. And just like there was a bit of a push from the comfort zone into your discomfort, there's another kind of push needed out of your personal evolution into the collective's resolution. You know, because again, there is a bit of a inertia there, you know, and it's going to take some effort and self-will to feel a sense of a larger purpose and service and commitment to the greater context, you know, that I do not journey alone. I belong to a larger system, and I am accountable not just to myself, but for the role I play in that larger system.
You connected the Shakti leadership, so that concept, also to our current situation. We're still, the podcast is recorded in January 2021. I'm living in Switzerland. We're having not a complete lockdown, but it's pretty much lockdown. I don't know what it's like in India right now. How do these two things, the Shakti leadership and what we just talked about, the hero's journey or even the conscious journey, how can we use that knowledge in our current situation globally? Because we're talking a pandemic now.
So it feels as if obviously the collective humanity has to face a crisis with a pandemic. So we have a fabulous framework of the hero's journey, which tells us what to do with the crisis, right? So apparently a crisis can be a wake-up call. So we can choose to frame the situation any way we want. We get to choose how we want to respond to it. It has happened. It is a terrible thing. It has taken so many lives. It has caused so much pain and suffering. No doubt, all of that, you know, loss of livelihoods, loss of money, loss of so much. And yet, we get to choose the meaning we make from it. This is Viktor Frankl's work, right? Man's Search for Meaning. So I'm not saying COVID is a good thing, but I'm saying we can make it a good thing by turning it into a hero's crisis, saying, what if we look at this as a crisis of humanity? What is it that humanity needs to dissolve and die to and release? What is it that we need to cultivate and develop and potentially that is sitting in us? What capacities? How can we evolve our own communities? And then how can we come back with those communities and be models for other communities to learn from? Mm-hmm. Right? This is how you basically, if life gives you lemons, you make lemonade.
And what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I know. I know. Have you got a sense after now, we are now 12 months into the pandemic, have you got a sense what the world, what we as the human race need to learn?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. So it's so clear, isn't it, that in fact, I just bought a beautiful painting by an artist because I so resonated with what she painted. And she paints this great mother giving a blessing, COVID, upon Mother Earth. And, you know, when she explains why she painted it that way, she said, COVID may look bad for humanity and business and all that, but it's been very good for Mother Earth, right? All the animals are, you know, running around villages of India. I don't know if you've seen any of those beautiful videos, you know. So plant life is regenerating, animal life is regenerating, you know, systems, natural systems are regenerating. It's excellent because humanity has been sent home, locked into their little rooms, so that the rest of nature can rehabilitate herself with the power of nature, right? So I think what's clear to me is what COVID, the good meaning that can be made is we have to dissolve to the sense of I and me and mine and what's good only for me. And we have, so it's the end of the me age, and it's time to enter what I'm calling the we age, okay? The me and the we together. Where I'm not saying we can only be we, because we have to still hold our unique individuality, because we each have a unique gift to bring to our collective. So we can't say, oh, I'm just going to dissolve my sense of self and merge with the whole. That doesn't work. It doesn't work that way, right? We each are a unique piece of the we puzzle. So the me has to be in the we, but harmonized with that, correct? So I think if we can dissolve to the ego, the limited ego self, and we can develop capacities of wholeness and compassion and inclusion and tolerance and collaboration. And this is a whole new skill set that actually humanity has not had to learn all these years in our evolution, because we were getting by with that competitive model. But its time is done. And now we have to learn collaboration skills, collaborative capacities. We have to learn systems thinking and how to live as a integral system, right? We have to learn how to live as parts of a greater whole and be in a dynamic equilibrium with everything else, right? So these are new capacities we have to train for. We have to learn. And if we can do that, then we are going to bring evolution first to ourselves. We will become bigger, better versions of ourselves for sure, right? But in the process, we will then bring very, very important and necessary skill sets that the world needs at this time. That's the elixir we bring back.
And it sounds very much that women are very good at those things already.
Yes.
Collaboration, working together, sharing with each other. These are sort of like the compassion, the empathy, that those skill sets are very feminine in my definition. So I think what you're describing, when I have to put it into my words, is like the only masculine world is coming to an end. Not to say the only feminine world will begin now, we come to that later, but it will have to be a mixture of both in kind of like a balance.
Yes.
In your book, you also talk about, let me just read it so I'm not making a mistake, the psychological wholeness. And you talk about the four sides that we need, and you're combining also different psychological models, which I really like. Could you just share what that model is about with us?
Yes. So, you know, Western psychology is very, very beautifully mapped for understanding human development. And so Eric Berne's model on transaction analysis, he talks about parent, adult, child states. And to become whole, according to the Eric Byrne model, you have to become the aware adult, where you have access to your parent self and you have access to your child self. Because you cannot only be one and let go the other, right? We need our curious, wondering, you know, innocent child self, even as we need to have our discerning, moral, wise, guiding parent self, correct? But what I realized, the Eric Byrne model does not cover, that Carl Jung covers, is the understanding of the internal polarity of our masculine self, what he calls the animus, and the feminine self that he calls the anima. And this is not just Jung, of course. This comes from the East. So in the Tao, you have the understanding of the yin and the yang as two complementary forces inside everything for it to exist. And yang is the active principle and yin is the receptive principle. And it's the play of these two forces that creates anything. In the Indic tradition, in the yogic tradition, we have the understanding of the Shiva and the Shakti. The Shiva is the still, pure presence, witness, consciousness, and Shakti is its dynamic, creative principle, and therefore called the mother or the feminine, right? In this model of psychological wholeness, I combine the anima animus of Jung and the parent child of Eric Byrne. And I put it together to say, to become truly psychologically whole, at a minimum, these four aspects of self need to be brought together and need to be equally mastered in order to be expressed in our challenges and situations. So I put it together and say, we have to become the wise fool of tough love. So wise is your parent self, fool is your child self, tough is your inner masculine, the animus, and love is your inner feminine, the anima. And as a leader, if you are psychologically whole, you also have the capacity to express your full power. Because we say, in order to come into your full power, you need to be a whole person. So many of us may have one or two or three of these aspects, you know, developed because of our personality or our preference or whatever, but rarely will a leader or, you know, have actually all four consciously built as muscles. You know, so for example, I know I have a preference for my wise and my tough self. Interestingly, you know, I've learned how to bring on my love and my compassion self to the workplace. You know, it came out much more easily as a mother and so on. But the fool is actually innately who I am. When I'm completely in my element, I am this joyful, ecstatic dancer, innocent child self. The Sufi in me comes alive. But I tend to put all that aside when I show up as a leader. So now I have learned, in order to take my own medicine, there are leadership moments, you know, challenging moments, when actually the only way to succeed in that situation is to lighten up and be foolish and playful and not take myself seriously.
Byrne talks, when it comes to describing the child as a three-part child, there is obviously the free child, then there is the rebel, the no, I don't want to do this, kid, teenager kind of thing, situation. And then there's the child who says yes to everything. In your model, are you including all three, or are you just taking the free child?
So actually, at the core of my model, if you see it like a cross,
yes,
center is what we call the individuated self. And that is a self that knows how to carry their presence. Okay. So at the heart of the Shakti leadership model is presence. So you will express your adaptive child or your rebellious child when you're not present. But when you are present, the child you are expressing is that free child.
It's basically really coming into our presence. So we're talking mindfulness, to be that free child that has no, I mean, that's the definition of the free child. There's no bad meaning behind this. There's just fun. There's joy. There's laughter. There's just, I want to dance now, or I want to just pull a face because I feel like it, regardless of the consequences. So that's in the model, helping then, when I understood you right, in certain leadership situations to dissolve maybe the tension or the conflict. Is that right? Could you give us an example when you allow yourself to bring that part to the table?
So we were going on this huge cruise on the Sundarbans in the Ganges, and we were going to take this group of 30 people, senior management team of a well-known organization. Well, I can't even give the company. It's called Ogilvy and Mehta. And it started raining in such a way that cars were drifting away, and you know, it was. And I remember the main organizer from the company was so stressed, and he didn't know what decision to take. This was late at night, and early morning, 6 a.m., all 30 people had to get on the boat. And he had to take a decision that would impact everybody's lives, right? So, and we had all planned, we'd all flown from all over the country, we were ready to just, you know, there was so much at stake. And everyone was going around looking so serious. And I remember just looking at his face, and for some reason, very spontaneously, I just burst out laughing, right? Because of the utter hilarity and powerlessness of that situation, saying so much for all our, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, as the saying goes in English, like nature is having the last laugh here. And this is a great moment to just lighten up and, you know, what more can we do? We've done it all. You know, we've done our best. So let's just laugh. Let's ease the tension here. And I have no idea what made me laugh in that moment, but he later on came to me. He still talks about it. He says, in that moment, you kind of broke the tension and something in me eased. And we just said, okay, let's just sleep on it. And we wake up in the morning and we'll prepare as if we have to go. And we'll also have a plan B, which is not to go and instead, you know, just cancel. We will keep both plans ready. We'll wake up in the morning and we'll see what the weather looks like, and then we'll take it from there, you know. So it broke the ice, it broke the tension, it broke, you know, and it, in that creative moment, the laughter just allowed both for easing up and for a sense of a more creative solution to emerge, you know. And everyone felt okay with that. So I've been known to do this. I mean, I've...
That brings us to the next model. It's that model where you have four sides. You have the feminine, you have the masculine, and you have the releasing the Shakti or blocking it. And it's kind of like giving examples of what positive feminine traits are and what maybe blocking feminine traits are, and the same for the masculine. And when I listened to you explaining it, you always go diagonal when you realize something is not working right. So in the example you gave, that male leader was clearly somewhere. So take it from here.
Yeah, so this, you're talking about the polarity map. It's the model and the work of Dr. Barry Johnson. And the first time I came across it, I remember thinking this is like a incredible... super weapon for breakthroughs of whenever you are stuck with an either or situation, to realize that there is a both and solution, you know, that you don't have to choose one or the other. You can get best of both. And this polarity mapping shows you that. So I'm going to share that with your viewers and listeners as well. But essentially it says that when we fall below the line, In this case, I'm working with masculine and feminine, but there are all kinds of polarities you can work with. In this case, it is masculine, feminine. if you fall below the line where you are getting best of both, you end up getting worst of both, right? And so if you become too masculine, like in this case, I think he was taking himself too seriously, and where he was becoming very rigid and very tight, and you know, just stressed, right? Holding the whole responsibility on his shoulders, but not in a easeful way, but you know, in a stressful way. So that would be called having fallen into hypermasculine energy of leadership. And the way the polarity mapping works, it says, if you have, it's like hot and cold running water. If you have too much cold water, dial up the hot. If you have too much hot water, dial up the cold. Simple. If he was being too masculine in this case, you know, just me laughing made him relax and ease up and in a way become more flexible, which is become more feminine, right? And so he perhaps reached for his healthy feminine ability to be more relaxed, more collaborative, more flexible, more open and creative. And, you know, so that's that, okay, what else can we do? That very adaptive way that women have, you know, which is the feminine in women. I think he was able to find that feminine pole in himself. And that brought him above the line to the healthy feminine, right? So in the same way, had he only stayed on and like, that's it, enough, I can't give, you know, now it's all going to be like, let's just go with the flow. If he had stayed in that mode, that too would have eventually dropped him below the line into hyperfeminine, which is he wouldn't have made a plan B, you know, and he would have put us all at risk. So the way to stay above the line in his case was to become more relaxed and to know that he has to go with the flow. So he called on his feminine side, but without neglecting his healthy masculine, right? Which is about how do I still make sure I have a plan B in place, right? And I have done the rational thinking as well. That way you stay in this healthy inhale and exhale between the healthy masculine and healthy feminine. And if you don't do that, you're doomed to fall below the line and have the unhealthy aspects of both. So had he not been present and had he not responded to the laughter and, you know, found his own healthy feminine and masculine, there's a good chance that along with being very tight and, you know, stressed and rigid in a hyper-masculine way, he could have also perhaps got, you know, hysterical or something, which is that health, which is the unhealthy feminine, right? So,
not very helpful. Not very helpful at all. The sense I'm having is that there is a belief in the male, maybe I'm wrong, but that if they give some space to their female side, they would lose it. They would not be the winner anymore. They would lose in their game. How can we convince specifically men now to make room for their female side? And that gives them then even more chances to achieve something that they want.
Yes, that's a good question. And, you know, we know that the patriarchy, which overvalues male and masculinity over the female and femininity, we know that the patriarchy, which has been the dominant system of social structures globally for thousands of years, today we are beginning to see that it has hurt the men as much as it has hurt the women, right? Men have had to go out and fight wars and lose, you know, parts of themselves. And by having to kind of suppress their feminine nature, they have paid the huge price of not being able to feel their feelings and in a way got dehumanized in the process, you know. And the truth is to feel your feelings makes us human, is a great privilege to be human, to feel feelings. And yes, of course, we don't want to feel bad feelings, but when we suppress feelings, we also don't feel the incredibly beautiful feelings of love and empathy and compassion and honor and respect and recognizing beauty and having your heart broken open to the bittersweet poignancy of life. You know, there are moments you just feel so grateful that you are human, that you can feel this incredible beauty of what it means to be alive, even in the heart of deep pain, you know. So all those capacities to feel, which ultimately bring us what we're really looking for, which is a sense of fulfillment, you know, a sense of being truly free. All that doesn't come only from thinking. It also comes from feeling. So you need access to both your thinking and your feeling capacities, your sensing capacities. And if you do not train that feminine muscle in yourself, then you also come out as half a person, you know. So it's like having gone to the gym and only built your right bicep and having forgotten to build the left one. So my invitation to men is, first of all, a deep gratitude for having brought humanity where it is today, all wonderful things that have come from healthy masculine qualities. You know, if my country is a free country today, it's because the majority of the army is made up of strong Indian men who don't sleep in high altitude glaciers, you know, keeping the enemy at bay, and we live as free people. We walk a free country because, you know, good men are doing good work, right? So I'm a naval officer's daughter, and I know this very well. I have deep love, respect, compassion for what men and the masculine brings to our world. At the same time, I know that if we look at the big problems humanity is facing today, the environmental crisis and, you know, mental health disorders, and every domain of human life is in some form of crisis. And it's because we are playing to our masculine strengths and we have not leveraged the feminine strengths to bring balance along with that. So we're not saying stop doing what you're doing. We're saying raise up what you're not doing. So continue doing what you're doing well, but also now build those other muscles that have been left behind, thinking they didn't count. But we now realize that they do matter, right? Our ability to feel and have empathy. So Brené Brown's work on vulnerability, that if you're just being strong isn't enough, if you don't know how to also be vulnerable as a leader and know that it's okay to make mistakes and let your, you know, your authenticity be seen by others, that in a strange way, people love and respect you more and are willing to follow you more if they see you as human. Yeah. That, you know, you too have your vulnerabilities. You're not some sort of a robot, you know, who's just going to be on 24/7 without breakdown, right? So, yes.
When I want to just underline one really important thing that I heard you saying. It is not about giving up something. When I did my NLP training years and years and years ago, it was always, it's not about losing a certain behavior. It's about putting another behavior there too and making you conscious and able to choose between several possibilities to behave. So it's not about giving up that male trait. Keep it.
Yes.
Because it's very powerful and it's helpful. And add to it another trait, the female trait. And the same for the women. Women, keep that female trait. Be compassionate and show your gratitude and collaboration and all that, and add the male part to your behavior and then see where that takes us.
Yeah, beautifully said, Anya. That's exactly it. You know, of course, what we do need to let go is any toxic behavior,
Yes.
And it can be toxic masculine as well as toxic feminine behavior. So yes. We know just like toxic masculine is aggressive and cruel and arrogant and insensitive, you know, there is toxic feminine behavior such as being smothering and sentimental and needy and dependent and unfocused and irrational or manipulative. So both sides have their healthy expressions and unhealthy expressions. What we have to let go are anything unhealthy, anything toxic, regardless of whether it's masculine or feminine, regardless of whether you identify as male, female, or, you know, transgender or anything, right? Anything toxic needs to be let go. But anything that's good needs to be kept, not because only it's good, because it's necessary for the collective. You know, without it, we'll have another set of problems.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I agree totally. Now, last question. And it's always the same question. Was there a question that you wished I had asked you that I didn't? Or was there something, or is there something where you say that is so important I would like to repeat it? Now is the possibility, the time for it.
Well, I think we will go back to your question on, is COVID a hero's journey? And, you know, I'm saying we have to make it our hero's journey, because from all the statistics and data out there, the planet was on a crash course. And if we hadn't achieved certain targets by 2030, we were going to be in a irrevocable place, actually. I do not want the COVID crisis to end until our main systems have made some sufficient transformations and changes. And each one of us has to really step up and play the role at this time. In fact, if we haven't done our personal hero's journey, it's like you need to really rush and complete that, because you're now going to be called to make the collective journey.
And basically bring whatever you learn in your individual journey to the collective journey, because yes. It will be a piece of the big puzzle.
Yes.
It will not be the entire tapestry, but it will be one part, and that part is important to make all the other parts work together and to overcome the challenge.
This thing that none of us are going to be okay until all of us are going to be okay.
Yes.
So we cannot hold on to our selfish needs anymore, because there is not going to be a we or a planet if we can't get to it together.
And that's a beautiful way of ending it. Thank you so much for taking the time to spend it with us, I say, as people and listening and hearing this podcast, sharing your wisdom. And I will make sure that I will put a link to the Shakti Leadership, to the book, definitely under the podcast so people can read it. I will link the two videos that you have provided for me in preparation so other people can share that too, to spread the word, because it's an amazing work you have done. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Anya. It was a delight.
You heard a production by Anya Förster. Copyright Anya Förster. Music by Audionautics.com.